You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm Professor Joe Kane. This is a bonus episode, but it's a bit of a somber note. It's a tribute to one of our colleagues here in the department. This year, we lost our friend and colleague, Dr. William McElhose. Bill was a historian of medieval medicine. As a specialist, he was an expert in theories of sleep and sleeping. More widely, Bill loved the history of medicine in all its forms and across all the world's great cultures. Bill was a great teacher, a much-loved mentor to students, and he was a lovely friend. Bill was always happy to lend a hand, and he played a big part in running the undergraduate and master's programs here in STS. This episode is an interview with Bill. Students in STS sometimes interview staff for projects in science communication. A few years ago, one of our master's students, Deirdre Deenan, did just that with Bill. After Deirdre heard of Bill's death, she very kindly offered us this recording. We thought broadcasting it would be a small tribute to someone we miss. In the interview, Bill is Bill. He talks about ideas and people. He encourages and he nurtures. This recording very nicely shows the roles Bill loved most. I spoke to Bill on the day he died. He was the person in this recording up to the very end. We pick up this recording in Bill's office with Deirdre asking the questions.
I'm Dr. Bill McElhose. I'm an historian of medicine and science at UCL in Science Technology Studies, and my field is actually medieval history, but my current research is on sleep and its pathologies, including things like insomnia.
Great, thank you. Okay, so sleep seen as a scientific mystery, really. So if you could just give me a bit of a summary on some leading theories of why we sleep, or some of the sort of key ones, that would be great.
That's a huge topic there. That's what's most interesting about sleep, is that it's still, to this day, there's so many unanswered questions with everything we know about REM and all kinds of different elements of looking at the little intricacies of sleep. We still don't have some basic questions answered. Well, there's a huge discussion going back to even the ancient Greeks, but particularly Aristotle argued, well, sleep is in one sense a negation. It is not waking. It is not consciousness. It is not the ability to perceive, to take in new sense perceptions. It is everything that wakefulness is not, and vice versa. So on one level, it's a very negative view. But on another, the argument is that sleep is really about, performs a very productive, important role, because it's what, not for Aristotle, but for later figures, particularly Galen, it's when blood is produced on a daily basis. Because before, William Harvey argued for circulation of blood, that blood doesn't, the blood is kind of moved throughout the body, recycled every day. The argument was that the body had to produce blood, and then it gets used up as it moves outward from liver and heart to the rest of the body. And the argument was that blood is produced by digestion, that all the food and drink we take in is precisely what leads to the production in the liver of blood, and that the best time, the only real time when this occurs, this production of blood and digestion occur, is during sleep. So sleep is not just about restoration of the muscles, possibly the brain, but it's also about recreation and actual generation, not even regeneration, but new creation of blood. That argument continues for a very long time. You have people kind of reciting, you know, strict Aristotelian doctrine in an almost religious way. Eventually, it has to be kind of altered with, of course, the argument for circulation of blood. But there's many different arguments, and I'm not sure which ones to pick as what's more essential than others. But generally, they fall into categories of what biological function does sleep perform, what psychological function does sleep perform, those can also, of course, be intertwined. But there are arguments from really the 60s and 70s onward, which are made purposefully to kind of provoke. And that is one argument that, you know, is sleep actually necessary? And you'd think that's a ridiculous question to ask. But there is an argument that, it's made by ethnographers and anthropologists, if sleep is about kind of hiding away from dangerous animals at night, then because we're much more protected now, we don't, you know, we're not out in some savannah where the, you know, some horrible creature might attack us, then do we really need sleep? So it's kind of taking biology and questioning, well, what is its the function of sleep? I think that's really meant to provoke more than a serious argument, but still it does force the question, which is still unanswered: what is sleep for? And most sleep researchers, most modern scientists, would agree, from my understanding, that we don't have a clear definition of what sleep is and what its function is. Does it have a proper function? It does seem to have restorative properties. I mean, that seems to be an important part of it. But then when REM was discovered in 1953, the recognition was, we need REM sleep. But what about the later categories, the four stages of slow wave sleep that come in? Do we, you know, how much do we need of those? And can we catch up on sleep? Because it's known that if we lose REM sleep, we do fall quickly into REM sleep the next time we go to sleep and kind of recover some of that quote-unquote lost REM. But there's so many things that are just still kind of unknown, whether it's zebrafish or humans or what have you. So.
And actually one of the reasons why they study sleep in zebrafish is because they have that sort of catch-up. Yes. If you deprive them of sleep, then they need to catch up on it. And when I asked Dr. Real, does he think we'll know why we sleep? He says a lot of the theories at the moment are sort of about restoration or this, that, and the other, but none of them can really explain why it's so offline that you have to just not just rest, you have to go to sleep.
Right.
So I think that's quite interesting. That was great.
And that's an important distinction, that rest versus sleep, because, yes, we could argue, we just need to close our eyes for a little bit. But what we know of sleep spindles and slow-wave sleep stages is that all of them are, to some extent, to a greater or lesser extent, necessary. And, yeah, it's a very strange phenomenon. Hmm.
Great. And what about a bit of the history of the search for a sleep gene that you mentioned?
Oh, right. it's not a gene. The issue is the sleep cause, I think, is the larger issue. What is it that forces the body to not function or purpose, but is there a trigger within the body? What I'd mentioned to you was that there are these, really from the late 19th, but certainly at the very beginning of the 20th century, exactly 100 years ago, actually, there were these attempts to find some substance that is the cause of sleep. And there are these really kind of, to us, kind of shockingly barbaric studies that were done by a Frenchman named Pierron, who was looking for this what he called a toxin, and he thought he found it, which was that he was studying dogs, and he would basically chain them to a wall, but chain them in such a fashion that they couldn't actually lie down. And so basically the only way they could properly rest was also the moment at which they would suffocate themselves. And what's, leaving the barbaric bit aside, what was amazing about it was that these dogs were able to survive for very, very long times. That is, this kind of will to live seemed to be far greater than any level of ability to stay awake that humans have been able to perform. But that wasn't his purpose. His purpose was to find, by finding a dog who did die from suffocation, to then extract something from the brain, and he looked various places to find this toxin. But he eventually found something that he decided was what he referred to as the hypnotoxin, the liquid that causes sleep. And it was, for him, this was the source of sleep. And he would inject it into other dogs, and they would fall asleep very quickly. Now, the question is that kind of some sort of endorphin caused by extreme exhaustion or what? Whatever? It's not clear. But for him, he was trying to say, we know what it is that causes sleep. And there are a number of other experiments, thankfully not quite so shocking as that, where people are looking for that moment, that element that leads directly to sleep. So I think I'll leave.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And it makes sense that people would look for something that might be that switch.
Exactly, yeah.
But now that seems so weird, but that's kind of...
The monocausality, I think, is weird. Like, why would we assume it's just one thing, and why do we have to turn into some part of the endocrine system or something? It's just, why look in one place only? I think that the kind of search for plurality of causes is what we kind of hopefully look for.
Okay, cool. And then what about some views of insomnia over time?
Yeah, weirdly, the views of insomnia are actually amazingly consistent. That is, I've been trying to work on an article on insomnia, and it's kind of, it's not really going anywhere because there's really interesting material, but it just doesn't seem to deviate from the basic arguments. Again, in the medical literature of the ancient and medieval and early modern worlds, insomnia is its own medical category. Weirdly, it's known as vigilia in Latin. That is, the word is the same word as wakefulness, as just normally being awake. But it's creating a distinction between normative and pathological waking. But eventually a term comes along that is insomneitas, insomnietas, basically something close to this idea of not sleeping. So eventually the terminology comes closer to what we recognize and away from, and separating it from the other form of wakefulness. But everything else about it is relatively consistent. The idea that excessive insomnia can lead to severe problems of the body, severe problems of the mind. The term alienation of the mind is a very common phrase. That it can even lead to death is recognized. But certainly the idea that you cannot function or think properly or normally is very consistent across time. What isn't consistent is what to do about it. Insomnia, the general difficulty of insomnia is how to kind of respond to it in a way that doesn't create new problems. The old arsenal of drugs was, and to some extent occasionally still is, opiates, narcotics, two versions of the same thing, but different drugs that had that were recognized to have very problematic consequences. It wasn't about addiction. The concern wasn't, opiates will lead to addiction. The concern was, this can actually cause complications and even death in the patient. So you have to be very careful with it. And that continues. I mean, opiates are morphine, etc., were being used extensively in the 19th century, and then you get the rise of newer attempts of drugs that were meant to reduce wakefulness or induce sleep, so hypnotics. But each of them has its own problems. So you've got various drugs that kind of became popular in the mid 20th century and then disappeared and then replaced by others that that were equally addictive and problematic. So it's not really clear what kind of curative solutions we have. But what is part of the problem is that there is this consistent recognition that it is largely a disease that is what we would call neurological. It's a disease of the brain. That is to say, it's seen as a psychological condition that has physiological consequences. And that, again, is quite consistent. I mean, yes, of course, fevers and other diseases have insomnia as a side effect, as a symptom or consequence. But the category, the nosological category of insomnia, was seen as having primarily, not always, this connection to the brain. And sometimes causality in the brain, i.e., in mental and emotional thoughts or behavior. It's strangely fairly consistent across time, and both consistent in terms of the frequency with which people record it. I mean, there's an obsession now that we're all insomniacs. You know, that somehow modern culture, modern technology, modern society, and the light bulb, right? I mean. That artificial light and stimuli are producing this world, and the book right there, 24/7, is a good example. Jonathan Creary argues that everything about modern society, about post-industrial capitalism, is leading towards this idea that you must be a worker and or consumer at all times, and that anything that isn't working or consuming is wasted time. I mean, the phrase he uses is, sleep is for losers. That if you're not Margaret Thatcher, sleeping only 3 or 4 hours a night, you're just not good enough. I mean, he's critiquing that. He's not advocating it. But that focus on insomnia is one that is seen as basic to so many cultures. I think we feel it more now, and I think because of the pace of society and technological developments. But it is something that's been there from the beginning. The association of thought, of a study with insomnia is very, very common. You basically, the idea that you have too much on your mind is one way that can lead to insomnia.
Yeah, and I think it's probably just why sleep is also so popular as a form of study as well. It's just, we all have to do it. It's so common, and maybe that's why people are so sort of like taken up by it as a thing to study.
You'd think that, except that, and certainly in the present it absolutely is, but it took such a long time for that to happen. I mean, there's a very good book by a man named Kenton Croker called The Sleep of Others, and it's a study of how sleep entered the lab. And previously, you know, even there's a huge amount of material, Descartes and all kinds of discussions that are mostly philosophical or theological or otherwise, but when does it become a scientific field of inquiry in and of itself? The focus of the late 19th, early 20th century was often on productivity, and it still is to some extent. Well, what is the problem with fatigue? How can we reduce fatigue in shift workers? Things like that. But sleep as a form, as a field of study, really only comes in the mid-20th century with some particular figures in Chicago, one of whom is the co-author, though not the finder of, not the discoverer of REM sleep. It's the PhD supervisor of a man named Azarinsky. The supervisor was Nathaniel Kleitman, who had been studying sleep as a phenomenon for decades. And then in 1953, he and a student published a paper on the discovery of this new thing that they initially called jerky eye movement and eventually became rapid. But it was really with that and Kleitman's career that suddenly sleep as a subject was worthy of study. But initially, people ignored him. And even actually soon after the discovery of REM sleep, there was still a kind of who cares reaction. And it wasn't really until the 60s that this desire to turn it into a field of study occurred. And it was in part because of psychology as much as physiology and neurology. That there's this, and that's what's interesting about sleep, is that it's as much about the mind as it is about the body. And, you know, that's why there's been a huge literature on dreams, but not much on sleep. Because dreams are vivid, dreams are lively. Whereas sleep, as that negation that I was saying, mentioning with Aristotle, if sleep is just a negation of activity, of sense perception, of thought, in the sense, the way that we understand it, of consciousness, then it's an empty space. But what people have recognized, of course, is that there's a huge amount going on there. And, you know, the hard part is to link up what's happening in the mind with what's happening in the body. So kind of the rise of neuropsychology and neuropsychiatry is one that's particularly interesting, because it is trying to bridge that gap between dream, how we dream, and what we dream content and the process of dream.
I didn't realize it was only sort of so recently, really, that it had taken off as a field of study.
Oh, it really is.
And can you tell me a little bit more about the discovery of REM sleep? Were they, what kind of experiments were they doing? How did they...
Well, it's a kind of funny one, because they it was an accident, actually, weirdly. The initial plan was to study infants as they fell asleep, and to be able to tell, basically to tell mothers when the child was about to be quiet, and, you know, you can go off and do something else. But it was about kind of these moments of brief early in sleep, this kind of the fluttering of the eyelids, etc. And so they had, Kleitman had already been kind of studying people while sleeping, but he wasn't looking for these patterns, and he wasn't necessarily studying the entire night. So what this PhD student was doing in 1952-53 was just, he hooked up electrodes, EEG machines a patient, or to a person who turned out to be his son, and left them on all night, which is to say, whole trees were destroyed in the process of creating this, because it was all just reams and reams of paper. But at one point, he just happened to notice, oh, I guess my son's awake, I should go in and see, because the brain pattern suggested that he was asleep. I'm sorry, but that he was awake, that the brain was incredibly active. The muscle tone seemed to suggest he was, later they realized the muscle tone suggested that he was asleep, that he was not, the muscle was not moving at all. And it was at that point that he went in and discovered, oh, he is asleep, but there's something weird going on with his eyes. And it was purely because he just happened to do a full night's reading and just note this moment of, oh, I should go in and make sure he's not terrified or something, that Ozarinsky discovered this thing that we now consider to be essential, and kind of shake our heads thinking, well, why did people not notice this before? And there's evidence that some might have, but didn't make any connections. So.
Cool. That's interesting as well. Okay, so I think that's everything apart from the song choices.
The song choices. Oh, God. Gee, I don't know. Well, first of all, to go to sleep, I don't think I don't listen to music.
Yeah, fair enough.
just because that music stimulates me so much that I would, have to then come down from that to go to sleep. Oh, I don't know. So what's the question? What would...
Okay, a song to get you out of bed in the morning.
on a day when I really need to get out of bed. Something like that? Okay. I'd have to say it's called post-rock is the genre. It's a band called Godspeed You Black Emperor from Canada. And they have one track in particular from an album called Lift Your Skinny Fists Like Antennas to Heaven. And it's the first track. And it just is this song that just kind of builds and builds and builds and builds until you just think it's just going to explode. And then... and then it fades away. But just that building is what kind of would
get you up.
Motivated, yes.
Great. And what about when you're reading and researching, do you listen to
music? No,
I can't. Neither.
It's just, I mean, maybe some really bland classical music.
I'm the exact same, I can't have anything.
It couldn't be vocal at all.
Yeah.
No, definitely.
Okay, well, that's perfect, great.
Cool. You're going to ask about narcolepsy, you didn't.
So. Oh. Well, because apparently, according to Dr. Real, narcolepsy is figured out. Early 2000s, they found the gene. If you lose the gene, okay. if you lose the hypoorexin system in humans, then you just get narcolepsy, apparently.
All right. That's it. We're done. Right.
But if you have anything interesting to say about it, I'd love to.
Well, no, there is good stuff on it, because the term was, I think, coined in the late 19th century, about 1880. And the argument was built around, again, this kind of issue of muscle tone. Initially it seemed to be something that was triggered by an emotional outburst. So this man, Gélinot, studied one patient who had this, who seemed to kind of have if he laughed very, very powerfully, very strongly, he would just fall asleep after, like, immediately. So it was triggered by some emotional outburst. And so for quite a while, the assumption was that it had this psychological cause. And so it was taken up more by psychologists than as much by psychologists as by physiologists. I'm not sure. It was only in the 70s that people started saying, okay, now hold on, let's move away. Let's see if it does have physiological, more clearly physiological causes. I hadn't actually known that they discovered some sort of gene that seems to nicely tie all the ends together. That's
nice to me. But actually,
I'm
now
a modern
that
scholar, modern historian. So,
but now that you mention it, I don't know what kind of study that was, or whether it was in.
Yeah.
So, well, he did mention humans, but so basically he said that he started studying sleep in zebrafish around the early 2000s because they'd found this sleep gene for narcolepsy, or they figured out the cause of narcolepsy being the loss of this system, the hypocretin orexin system.
And that's what inspired him to go into the field.
Ooh. Yeah, and then also that it's sort of the dogma was overturned that non-mammals sleep, and that these simple model systems like zebrafish and C. elegans show sleep-like states. So they tried to sort of figure out a system to do that. So now they have these, like, 96 well plates where they put zebrafish and they record them, and they have, like, phased light systems, and they record the movement, and it goes into a big tracking system, and they can tell.
Oh, I should tell him. He and I should talk, because my sources describe they're working from Aristotle, who says, yes, of course, all animals by definition sleep. Plants do not, he says, but what distinguishes plants from animals and humans, who are the higher form of animal, is this ability that we need sleep. And he says, and Aristotle's very clear, well, we know that they must sleep because by definition the animals must sleep by the definition he's just created, but that we can't always tell with fish and some birds, and so he kind of recognizes that there are some problems with this, and some of my sources, some medieval sources, say, well, what about this particular fish? And fishermen tell me that they see them heading towards the bottom of the river in the Danube. And so these really interesting little kind of attempts to say, well, Aristotle must be right. And it turns out he is. but not for the reasons that he thought. I mean, his reason was, we animals must do this because they need it. Plants don't. There's a UCL, it must be his lab. There's some lab at UCL that has a little fish sleeping with bubbles coming up off it, which I assume must be, it's some group here that are.
I think they're really keen on sort of communication and public outreach and stuff like that. I'm sure he would like to talk to
you. Yeah, no, I'd love to talk with him too. I'm not sure. You know, it'd be interesting to see what kind of connection.
If you could sort of prove Aristotle.
Oh, no, I have no interest in that, but proving him right or wrong. But what matters to me is what people thought, not whether he's right or
wrong. Right or not.
I don't care. So.
Let me close the show by thanking Deirdre Deanan for offering us her interview. She's finished her degree now, and she's spent the last few years building a great career. Let me also thank a current STS student, Nuza Mia. Nuza's helped edit this particular file, and she's fine-tuned the audio. Nuza's had a summer studentship helping us out with the podcast, and she's had a big impact. Music for today's episode is Classical Piano Waltz by Music L Files and Feather Waltz by Kevin MacLeod. Both are available on the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. We'll have another bonus episode soon. Until then, I'm Professor Joe Kane, and thanks for listening.